Arts Roundup with Simon Burton on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Cambridge Arts Roundup. In a summer that feels full of physical energy as we celebrate sport, art and the human body in an exciting local exhibition, and then go on to delve more deeply into our cultural past as we look at medieval history and its bounty of music, art and illustrated scrolls. In this edition, I visit the curators of Paris 1924 Sport, Art and the Body exhibition celebrating the 1924 Olympics at the Fitzwilliam Museum, which runs through till November and has plenty of riveting material to offer, as well as interesting social comparisons with the Olympic Games we've just been witnessing. I'll also encounter medieval historian Katie Hawkes to talk about the relevance of our past and how life in the medieval era shaped much of our cultural assets.
Au-delà des mers, là-bas sous le ciel clair, il existe une cité au séjour enchanté. Et sous les grands arbres noirs, chaque soir, vers le s'en va tout mon espoir. J'ai deux amours, mon pays et Paris. Par elle toujours, mon cœur est ravi. Manhattan est belle.
There's nothing quite like a trip to Paris to enliven the emotional parts other cities cannot quite reach with a degree of elegance and panache. And this summer, the city's been the uplifting beacon in a world with oh so many horrific woes. If you haven't had the opportunity to visit the Paris 2024 Olympic Games, the answer I can highly recommend to uplift your spirits is to visit the Paris 1924 Sport, Art and Body exhibition currently underway at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, which shows the past of the Olympiad that inspired the Chariots of Fire film and portrays the reality as a deeply cultural affair that explored physical excellence and many artists' attempts to capture it for posterity. It features astounding art and photography and a story that inspires deeply, and features Johnny Weissmuller as an iconic figurehead with what was regarded as male physical perfection in a body for a sport reaching for a new level. Chris Young, co-curator and professor of German at the University of Cambridge, and Caroline Vaught, professor of classics at the University of Cambridge, introduced the exhibition.
Well, I mean, the idea for the exhibition actually wasn't mine. It was my co-curator's, and he wanted to do an exhibition on sport. And 2024, obviously, it's Olympics again in Paris. So it was a perfect moment to celebrate that centenary. And the Paris 1924 Games were, you know, the first sort of really international games, 40-odd countries competing. They were the first games to have radio commentary. But what's really special about them is the fact that they were in Paris. And Paris in 1920 is this extraordinary cradle of modernity, jazz, cabaret. Every artist worth their salt gravitated towards it. And so we wanted to celebrate all of that. We wanted to think about the ways in which representation and reality came into conflict in a very particular kind of way to change not only what sport was and what it looked like, but then change society and what bodies looked like more broadly. It's really important, I think, to remember that these games happen at that interwar moment. And that's important because you've got to remember that not only is Paris this vibrant city, but it's a city in which many people have lost their loved ones, in which other people are walking around with very visible disabilities. And that makes the representation of the body all the more charged. And artists are experimenting with ways of representing the body, some of them going back to the Greek ideal and the integrity that comes with that, but others exploring really radically different ways of representing the body, breaking it down into broken pieces or representing it in a far more abstract, machine-like way that sort of transcends human frailty.
And what were the politics of the time?
Well, in terms of the sports politics at the time, I think a lot of people might want to try and draw a line between 1924 and 1936, because 1936 in Berlin, the famous so-called Hitler Games, other games that are burnished in the memory. But in terms of 1924, the only real fascist moment would have come from the Italian team, Mussolini in power already, and pushing sport at that early stage. But apart from that, in terms of the politics, I think in the grander scheme of things, what's been striking for me in these games is that it's open to everyone, that globally teams come from all around the world. They are the most global games, and artists will pile in, really, and express themselves through sport at this point. So I see this as a really open moment, a moment more of optimism and a fascination with the present and the future.
How did you source all the material?
Well, we had a wonderful research assistant, Rebecca Virag, who works here at the Fitzwilliam, and she's been tremendous. And there's been a whole range of inputs from people, but it's been a global search, really, hasn't it, Carrie? Yeah.
You know, there are moments when you're trying to tell a story and you know there's material out there that will kind of play to that story. And you do lots of searching on the internet to find the kinds of objects that you know must exist, and you find them, but then how do you get your hands on them? Much of the material that's in our show is in private collections. And if it hadn't been for Rebecca, we'd never have been able to track that down.
What is the story?
It tells a story of individual triumph. Some of those individuals that triumph have a particular link to Cambridge. If Cambridge had been a country, it would have come ninth in the medals table, which is quite an extraordinary thing to say, but is true. But it also tells a much more global story. And it tells a story, for example, about the ways in which in 1924, you could win exactly the same medals for painting and for sculpture as you could for winning the 100 metres. And that's something that most people don't know. But it also then tells stories about the ways in which artist endeavour and athletic endeavour come together to change ideas of body image, gender and race in really fundamental ways. You know, this is a period in which women in France, they're still fighting for the vote. So although there weren't many women in these games, some of the women that were in the games go on to have huge public profiles, and seeing them in their little tennis dresses without corsets on or in their tight-fitting swimsuits changes everybody's perception of what a woman is and what she can do.
There are some fantastic photographs of women tennis players and women in action in the exhibition. You've got lots of amazing posters. I mean, they're the kind of posters that people would die to own. Tell me about some of the particular highlights in the exhibition.
I think what's a particular highlight of this show is its multimedia nature. Mm-hmm. So you've got everything from posters to tickets to football boots to a bobsleigh, works by Picasso, Delaunay, Jack Yates. One would be Alexander Calder's wire sculpture of the gold medal winning tennis player Helen Wills. Mm-hmm. And this is an extraordinary object because it really is just made from pieces of wire. And you will see it silhouetted against a wall. And it kind of abbreviates this extraordinary tennis player to just this wonderful, balletic, elegant line, which emphasizes the white visor that she always wore, and then her breasts, and then her skirt, and then her racket. And if you were to jump on the floor beside the case, please don't do this. But if you did, it would bob ever so slightly. So it has this gorgeous movement to it. And the other object I would flag is completely different. A little plaster figure that was made to celebrate the 1924 games of a swimmer with a huge head. Its aesthetic is much more cute rather than elegant. And she's there on the edge of her diving board about to jump in. And she's just fabulous.
Now, there are lots of film clips around the exhibition which kind of bring it to life, don't they? Because you see all of those sort of Chariots of Fire type people doing amazing things.
Picking the films was a great pleasure and challenge, actually, because we could have picked so many different things. So the show begins with flickering images of from the official film. It was a long film, it's 3 hours, and we have those in dialogue with actual objects. So you will see people wrestling from the 1924 games. You will see them set against casts from the museum here, and that sets up really a dialogue between representation and reality throughout the show. But I think one of my favourite film clips has got to be the bobsleigh, because we have an actual bobsleigh. We're not sure whether it competed in 24, we can't make that claim, but it's from Switzerland in the 1920s. and that sits in front of a film of from the winter film, which was much shorter, but of people hurtling down the bobsleigh without helmets on. It's really very dangerous.
Is there a sort of a tinge of elitism? Obviously, you have all of these wonderful stills of Harold Abrahams and Eric Liddell, and all of the kind of chariots of fire as a centrepiece in the exhibition. I mean, what does it say about Cambridge, do you think?
Well, I mean, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Oxford are the universities that are providing large swathes of the Great Britain team at that point. And we do want to celebrate that, but we also want to put that within its Great Britain context and within its wider international context. And we do that by emphasising, I mean, I'll just give you one example, a British swimmer called Lucy Morton, who is not from any of those institutions. She is from Blackpool, and her father was in domestic service, and she can swim because places like Blackpool have municipal baths. And she goes off to Paris, more or less on arrival, has a crash in a taxi and loses her teeth, and then goes on to win the gold medal, the only gold medal that the team win in the 1924 Games. And that story is a wonderful story, as wonderful as the Harold Abrahams story, and enables us, you know, to think about these things as a conversation. It's not the first Games at which women are included, and, you know, we should make it clear that we're talking about 130 odd women out of all of those athletes. They are a very small minority. But Helen Wills goes on to be an international star. Artists are clamouring to depict her. She screen tests for Hollywood, and, you know, she becomes the face of the mural that speaks of California on the walls of the San Francisco Stock Exchange. So yes, these women are, you know, it is an important moment.
There's also lots of wonderful artefacts like clothing of the time, which are amazingly colourful, running shoes, all kinds of things positioned in the exhibition. But there are some really classic artworks like Gino Severini's The Dancer, The Gymnast by George Groats, and sculptures by Umberto Boccioni as well. Those are really beautiful.
They're not only beautiful, but they're powerful. And I think what for me is thrilling, having sat through an installation for the first time, this is my first ever exhibition, is to know that those objects are sitting together for the first time ever. So you are not going to, it's a bit like having your fantasy dinner party. I've been describing this as, who would you like to put together? And to see those together as an expression of what was going on in Paris at the time. The Boccioni is pre-war, or during the war actually. The vibrancy of the time, the way that artists sought to capture speed and movement, how they dissected bodies but put them together in very dynamic ways, and I think very hopeful and positive ways, and they're just amazing. If you come to the show, you come out of the first phase where we're looking at the athletes almost in black and white. There's quite a black and white and sepia feel to that due to the nature of the objects. And you come into the second gallery and it bursts into life and colour.
Do you think sport as art as the theme of the second part of the exhibition is going to be something that will return with the Paris Olympics in 2024? The whole idea that you can actually, you can get so much out of it as artists and photographers, watching people performing these amazing feats.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Because, I mean, in 1924, it's a period before the Leica camera, and arguably a period, therefore, in which if you want to capture the dynamism of sport, you're better off doing it in paint or in graphite than you are in photography. We're now no longer in a period like that. Photography is extraordinary now. And I think sports photography generally, it is an art form, and it's underestimated as an art form. And I think, you know, Instagram, again, enables everybody to frame their own view as they sit there watching, you know, the Olympics unfolding in front of them. In terms of whether there are modern equivalents of George Groats, or, you know, contemporary artists don't seem quite so interested in sport anymore. I mean, for me, I've kind of got to go back to Francis Bacon or someone to kind of, you know, get that. But I do think it's photography that is now kind of leading the way, in which we, you know, need to see more of, actually.
There's some great sculptural works, obviously, and statues and things throughout the exhibition, which make it amazing. But I think one of the wonderful things at the end of it is that giant poster of Johnny Weissmuller as this kind of male icon, and you've got a giant Tarzan poster.
Yeah.
He was one of those people who was considered to be physically perfect in every way, wasn't he?
He was. I mean, he wins multiple medals at the Games and goes on, as you say, to be the absolute darling of Hollywood because of his physicality. You know, and he makes a great Tarzan because he's a great swimmer, and you know, any opportunity to have Tarzan swim, and that's what happens. He represents BVD, he represents Janssen, and is photographed wearing their swimwear. So we tend to think of brand endorsement as a kind of modern thing. You know, Emma Raducanu, there, the poster girl of Dior or whatever. But actually, it's already happening in the 1920s and 30s.
What would you like people to take away from this exhibition?
For me personally, and I think for Carrie, my co-curator, really is the power of sport as a force for good, a source of joy, a source of inspiration, and a source of triumph and overcoming. I think that's really run through this show in different ways. And also that there is a dialogue between art, stroke culture, and sport at every level through the show. And I was delighted yesterday to hear one of the museum staff, drenched in art really, say that they were really keen to watch the Olympics properly for the first time, having seen this show. So if that sort of dialogue can go back and forward. And also every time, even though we've been involved in the curation of this, every time I go through the gallery, I see something different. And I think this show will have something for everyone. So if it opens up questions that we haven't thought of when we were putting the show together, that's a really magical moment. So I think individuals will see different things, and that would be wonderful.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105. It's been most interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You found us.
This is Cambridge 105.
If you were to ask yourself where does British culture and society originally spring from, you might find that much of it sprang directly from the medieval period in terms of its foundations, where music was a key form of spiritual expression. Medieval historian Katie Hawkes has recently finished a PhD on Merton Priory in Cambridgeshire and directs St Radigan's Voices Medieval Choir you've just been listening to. She's taught history in local schools and to university undergraduates and takes us on a journey of how diverse life and art was in the age of Chaucer and Guy of Merton. Tell me about St Radigan's Voices, a beautiful piece of music there. What have you been doing?
Well, we started slightly accidentally. There was a course run by Cambridge Early Music on the music of an abbess in Ferrara who was actually Lucretia Borgia's daughter. Nuns weren't supposed to write music, but she did. Rather good music. Anyway, at the end of the course, I overheard one of the participants saying, "What a shame there isn't an all-female early music group in Cambridge." So I founded one.
Is medieval music kind of a dying art? Is it something that people are letting go, or is it something that's going to have a revival, do you think?
I think there's a great appeal in meditative music, and medieval music was largely meditative church music, largely monophonic, that is one line, so what we call plain chant. And I don't think that's dying at all. I think people are actually really quite interested in that. There was a resurgence, again, with a slight Cambridge link. Chris Page, who's at Sydney Sussex, sort of rediscovered the music of a 12th century abbess called Hildegard of Bingen. And she's made a big comeback. And she's rather good, actually. Again, it's a single line chant, which you can then harmonise. But again, very meditative. Really interesting woman.
Medieval Cambridge, I'm told it was quite a squalid place.
Oh, I should imagine so. It's got a river running through it. In the early Middle Ages, the climate was warmer, so there was probably malaria. All the dwellings, apart from these grand places that the king financed, were pretty grotty, you know, slightly temporary shacks. So you've got to imagine it's like more like a sort of Delhi shanty town.
And it was basically built around the Roman bridge, which gave Cambridge its name, Cambridge, which was basically a settlement around there, medieval settlement, that was a squalid, dirty place that everybody had to use to cross the river.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, river is the really important thing, because we nowadays think about transporting things in terms of road or possibly rail, but waterways were the transport method, and so Cambridge being on a river was actually a reasonably important market town.
How difficult would it be to get a clean glass of water?
There is this theory that people drank small beer, that's very weak ale, because that was a way of getting safe drinks. But that's been challenged, actually. And I think if you were, as long as you were the right end of town, then you probably could get some clean water. Monks, they were really, really clued up on waterways and waterworks, and they made sure that their water was pretty clean. And the first thing that they would do when they sized out a piece of land to build their monastery on was work out where they could have wells, channels, where they could have their latrines. At Merton Priory, it's thought that the latrines, it was a sort of long drop latrine into a little stream which went into the fish ponds. The fish ate the poo and the cannons ate the fish.
Merton Priory is something that you've done quite a lot of work on.
So my dad got involved in Merton Priory in trying to get it into being a little museum. Sainsbury's owned the site. They had to have a massive dig there. And they built a road, a bridge over the Chapter House foundations. And it is now a little museum. And it was while I was doing the exhibition boards for him that I thought, well, here's a major monastery that no one's really written about. I'd like to do a PhD. I'll do it on Merton Priory.
What would life be like in Merton Priory? I mean, I actually lived in Biggin Abbey for a while, which was a very old abbey as well. So I know what they're like inside. Was Merton Priory, what kind of a place would it have been?
It would have been really quite large. We think of the priory or monasteries in terms of the cloister, which is the main sort of quadrangle or court, which Cambridge colleges replicate. And we think a bit about it in terms of the church and maybe the dormitory and those bits. But actually the precinct, that is the grounds of it, were absolutely enormous. They had to feed themselves from it. They had to obviously get all their water and stuff. And so it was more like a big estate.
What took place inside the abbey? Because it would have been to study prayer and daily life. What kind of things would they have been studying in the abbey?
My lot were Augustinians, like at Barnwell in or just outside Cambridge, and they were big theologians, and they had connections with the University of Paris, which was a huge theological centre. They were also very closely connected to Oxford, which was the first university in England, and Cambridge was founded actually when Oxford, there was a murder by one of the students and the whole of Oxford erupted into riots and the scholars escaped to Cambridge.
Now, first of all, I mean, they would have used these medieval manuscripts, many of which, there are things from the ancient world which appeared in Oxford and Cordoba and places like that, which people had saved. They would have read these manuscripts and they would have studied what's called a trivium, wouldn't they?
That's right. Yeah. There's the trivium, which is all to do with the word. So that's logic, grammar and rhetoric, the art of speaking. And then you went on, once you'd mastered those, you went on to the quadrivium, which is all to do with number. So that's astronomy, geometry, arithmetic and music. Music was really important for monks and canons and nuns and even friars because they had to chant the Psalms every day. In fact, they had to get through the whole of the Psalms every week. And so they spent much of their time in church, 8 hours a day, and they could be hours or they could be longer. And so actually time for study was relatively limited. They could work in the afternoon, say. Some orders of monks, the Cistercians, for example, preferred manual work. So you had to go out and labour in the fields and things. But others, like the Augustinians, liked their books.
So basically you had this life. Part of it was the study, which was mastering your sense of religious orientation to the world. Then there was art, which was all religious in those days, wasn't it? And music as well. So you had this kind of world that people lived in that was deeply spiritual, really, wasn't it?
Very much so, yes. Spirituality underpinned the religious life, but it also underpinned many people's lives, and the whole point about monasteries was to pray. Well, they didn't just pray for themselves, they prayed for everybody else. And so if you were a wealthy merchant of Cambridge, you might actually donate some money or some artwork to the local monastery as a devotional act. And these monasteries were full of artwork, not just manuscripts, beautiful manuscripts, some of which you can see in, for example, the Fitzwilliam Museum. And they've digitised some of these, like the Macclesfield Psalter, which is absolutely crazy. But we do know that Barnwell Priory had a scriptorium. That is a place where they copied out manuscripts. And so we suspect that actually Barnwell had a lot to do with the early books of Cambridge University. But we just don't have the evidence to be really sure there. Well, one of my favourite manuscripts is actually just in Cambridge University Library. And it's a 13th century Bible. It's not pretty. It doesn't have any beautifully illuminated capitals with nice little stories going on. It's quite scrawled over. It's very well used, very well thumbed. It's quite dirty. There are a lot of this is all made of parchment, which is animal skin, and it attracts the oil of hands. So it's all quite grubby. But it's actually a really exciting book because in the 13th century, the Bible, I mean, we think of the Bible now as a book, but Bibles in the 13th century or 12th century were generally different parts of the Bible. It wasn't, you know, one huge amalgam. Unless you went to Italy and then you had what was called an Atlantic Bible, which was massive, about the size of this table. But in the 13th century, by the 13th century, biblical scholarship had come on and theology had come on so that people actually needed the Bible as a reference book. And so they were looking at ways to compile it and put it together. And this is one of the sort of experimental ways of putting the Bible together. So it shows that my canons, the residents of Merton Priory, were really in touch with the latest theological fashions.
It was very difficult to get hold of books, really, during that period, wasn't it? So having anything decent to read must have been extremely important.
Yeah, these books were really expensive. There's another manuscript in the university library which belonged to the great theologian Robert Grosseteste, who was also Bishop of Lincoln. And it says in his writing at the top, it says, I give this book to the monks of Bury St. Edmunds in return for another book which I want to borrow from them. And so if I don't give them this book back, they can keep this one. And clearly he didn't give the book back because the monks of Bury St. Edmunds still had that manuscript.
And were these manuscripts in Latin or in Old English like Chaucer wrote in?
They're all in Latin until the 14th century when you start getting some French and Middle English. French romances, though, were earlier. So some of the monks copied out not religious texts, and they could be in Norman French.
And presumably, as we go through, I mean, the medieval period ran from 476 to about 1450, and later in the period, presumably, you got more and more elaborate calligraphy and artwork embossed into the work. Are there any manuscripts that you can talk about that have things that have symbolism in them, have messaging in them, that are imagery and show artistic talent?
There's huge artistic talent in all sorts of these things. The symbolism, I mean, every saint had a symbol. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you saw two keys, it's Peter. You can go around Cambridge or London or anywhere, actually, and look at churches, and there'll be lots of saint symbols about. The Macclesfield Psalter I mentioned is a fabulous, literally fabulous, that is, you know, telling stories. What you get is the illuminated capitals with the sort of scenes from the Bible or religious imagery. But then at the bottom of the page, or even all around the margins, you get these like killer snails fighting knights and lots of bottoms. They really liked bottoms, so sort of apes peering into bottoms. It's absolutely fantastic.
Now, obviously, there were very strict rules to what you did with your artwork, because if you did anything that fell outside the parameters of what was allowable, or something nasty could happen to you, couldn't it?
Something nasty could happen to you. It could count as heresy, and you could end very stickily. Heresy got worse as the Middle Ages progressed. So after the Black Death, social strictures became a bit more. People were worried about fractures happening in the Catholic Church, which was the universal church in Europe, but different people were challenging bits of the church. So John Wycliffe, for example. And so in the 15th century, heresy really starts getting, you know, snowballing. And of course, that's when witchcraft starts as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at a film like Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose, do you think that would be a reasonably faithful portrayal of what life would have been like then?
I think the film's not bad. The book is brilliant. I love the book. I think Eco really gets the spirit of the monastic Middle Ages. Although the library, there was never a library that was that big or that centralised. We think of libraries being one single room, but they weren't until the 15th century. They were just little book chests here and there. So the library is a complete fantasy. But he does, you know, of course, he uses the book to discuss, universal ideas. But I think, yes, a lot of it is very accurate.
They did some pretty interesting things with architecture, though, didn't they? Even during that period, in so much as that they didn't necessarily build rooms in the way that you would have had nicely squared away. They had lots of features in the architecture that was strange and interesting as well, didn't they?
I think they really understood the importance of telling stories, and so you tell stories in your architecture as well as in your books and in your songs, and I think that we need to imagine, say, the bigger spaces like a church or a castle, we need to think of them in terms of procession and in terms of being dynamic, not just sitting in them, but actually moving around them and what you want to see when. So they are actually a series of theatre sets. And you can really get that when you go into a medieval church.
I mean, the Leper Chapel, obviously, is a wonderful example in Cambridge, down just as you go into the Fenditton area. And actually, people would have been much smaller then than they are now.
Yes.
That's one of the... And if we step back in time through a portal or something, we'd be amazed at how small all the people would be.
Yes, you would have been my size.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and so the buildings were much smaller, entranceways and doors and things like that. And that kind of gives it a sort of slightly weird slant, doesn't it, when you imagine life as it would have been. Now, could you paint a picture of what medieval Cambridge would be like socially?
Socially, it's quite like now, I should imagine. But you've got, on the one hand, you've got all these religious houses here and there. You've got the great Barnwell Priory out on what's now Newmarket Road. You've got the friars dotted around Cambridge, and they are sort of like monks, but they're a bit more outward facing, so they might staff the local parish churches. There are loads of parish churches. The colleges have, you know, like in the 18th, 19th centuries, 20th centuries, pulled down a whole load of churches, but there were loads and loads of churches, and so Cambridge actually was probably quite noisy with church bells going off all the time. Then you had merchantry. You had it was a very, very busy merchant centre, and I think the river would have been heaving actually with business and people, and then also you did get town and gown flare-ups, so there were riots, there were murders. You know, the students were a rowdy bunch.
Well, I mean, it sounds so. It would have been this kind of bustling city, and obviously Stourbridge Fair was south of Cambridge, where everyone traded in goods and things like that. Do you think that the Canterbury Tales basically gives you an idea of how it was socially? Because, you know, you had everyone was stuck in their position, weren't they?
Yeah, again, we're talking, you know, sort of post-Black Death, where this stratification just got worse. But yeah, I think the Canterbury Tales is a brilliant, brilliant snapshot of social life.
I think it also shows you this with a certain amount of clarity, that all the issues of humanity were very much the same as they are today, because people behaved in pretty much the same way.
People are people are people. Oh, going back to this Bible in the university library, at some point, one of the readers got really bored and started doodling on pages. And so people did have these sort of brown studies, and yeah, people are people. And in fact, another really good snapshot into medieval religious life, bishop's visitations, because every so often a bishop had to go and make sure that monasteries were behaving themselves, and they write reports on these. And so the out in Shropshire, for example, the bishop visited a nunnery in the 14th century and roundly told off the prioress for keeping hunting dogs and going hunting.
I mean, you talk a little bit about the saintliness of Guy of Merton as a figure, but people on the one hand were very tied up with being saintly and good and all the rest of it, but then they committed terrible sins and there were houses of ill repute and all kinds of other things went on as well, didn't they?
Oh, certainly did, certainly did. I was reminded of the Winchester geese the other day, which were, in the city of London, the citizens of London didn't want bawdy houses, that is, prostitutes, in the city. So they were all relegated to the South Bank, to Southwark. And all of these bawdy houses were leased on land belonging to the Bishop of Winchester. And so all the prostitutes were called the Winchester geese.
Okay, so now, life for women, how was life for women in that era?
If you were a peasant woman or a merchant woman, then life was probably all right. It was pretty hard. And, you know, your husband could legally beat you and all of that sort of thing. But you worked. If you were an aristocrat, you bred. You know, you were just a broodmare. You were supposed to bang out children. And then they were given to wet nurses so that the period, your sort of fallow period, was very short, so you could bang out another child. And so your life was probably pretty short because without modern medicine, 1 in 10 women die in childbirth. So that was not great. If you were an aristocratic woman, you might escape this by becoming a nun. But even there were certain freedoms that nuns had. But actually, in comparison to male monasteries, they were very restricted. In 1300, the Pope issued a decree called Periculoso, which came to Britain, and the bishops went out to convents to serve this decree. And the Bishop of Lincoln served it to some certain nuns at Markgate in Hertfordshire. And as he was riding out of the convent, they threw it back at him. And this said that nuns weren't supposed to leave their convent.
Now, if you were creatively inclined in the medieval era, you probably had quite a lot of obstacles in your way in terms of being able to develop artwork in the medieval period, wouldn't you?
Yes and no. As a woman, we know that nuns did copy manuscripts. We know that there were nuns who were illuminators. We know that there were nuns who were composers and singers. If you were a tradeswoman, you could run a workshop. If your husband died, you might take his over. But near Cambridge is Bury St Edmunds, and one of the most famous embroideresses of the Middle Ages lived there. She was called Mabel of Bury, and her work was second to none. We must remember that all the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, are essentially misogynistic. And there's no getting away from that. And Christianity became particularly misogynistic when it became the Roman religion. But actually in the early Middle Ages, life was better for women. It got worse especially after the Black Death. It was much more restricted, but probably, you know, from about the 11th century onwards, it was getting worse. Arguably, the nadir was the 18th century.
And I suppose that singing would have been something that created a kind of bond that kind of was above that, to a certain extent, amongst people, because you could express yourself creatively in a certain sort of way that allows you to shine in a way that you can't actually be challenged on in any way.
Very much so. In religious life, chant is the mainstay of it, and you get some really, really exciting, innovative chant written all by anonymous people, of course, because you were supposed to be anonymous. If you're singing outside the church, you're singing as a social activity, you're singing as a memorization technique, actually. So there's lots of reasons for singing, and everybody was making music all of the time, and men and women too. So these travelling musicians musicians would be male and female.
Now the dissolution of the monasteries took place. When did that take place?
Well, it was 1536 for the smaller monasteries, mm-hmm. and then 1538 to 1540 for the larger ones. It's really interesting, actually, because... well, I mean, just first of all, imagine how different life would be now if we still had the monasteries. Mm. But also, it was actually completely unexpected. Mm. When I was at school last century, our A-level, we were taught at A-level that monasteries were really corrupt by the 15th century and nobody wanted them. And then Luther came along in Germany and said, we don't need monks anyway because we don't actually need all this prayer. And so everyone went, oh, right, well, we don't want monasteries because they just take all our money and don't do anything with it. But that's absolutely not true, and various historians have found more and more evidence that this was not the case. And that actually by the 16th century, there'd sort of been a peak of immorality sometime in the 14th century, and monks and nuns were getting more and more focused and moral, if you like, throughout the 15th century. This is a bit of a crude generalisation. But by the 16th century, it was hard economically to be in a monastery because rents were not commensurate like they had been, so there was less money about. But basically, people liked monasteries and nobody expected them to be dissolved, and it was utter opportunism. I liken it to Brexit. Nobody expected it. Everybody said, what a stupid idea. We knew that Brexit would bring economic downturn. And the dissolution of the monasteries also brought an economic downturn for everybody except the few who grabbed land from it. And it was a complete welfare disaster because monasteries were also hospitals.
It was a kind of coup from above as well, wasn't it, in a certain way, from the point of view of power?
Oh, very much so.
And it does have that similarity as an event of that kind of significance, or larger probably in that era. It would have been a massive thing.
It was the biggest land shake-up since 1066. And if you were a king's minister, you could do very well out of it. Lewes Priory down in Sussex was closed in order that Thomas Cromwell could give it to his son as a country seat.
When you break up the monasteries, obviously all of the manuscripts with their wonderful artwork and calligraphy and knowledge dating back to the ancient period, you know, there would have been chaos in terms of preserving those things, wouldn't there?
Yeah, a lot was lost. And we owe, actually, again, if we use Cambridge, mm-hmm. there's a wonderful collection in Corpus Christi College, which is the Parker Library. We owe some of the most fabulous manuscripts, their survival, to Archbishop Matthew Parker, who was Elizabeth I's Archbishop of Canterbury. And he collected certain manuscripts, not for their beauty primarily, I bet he did, but for their historic nature.
I think having painted a picture of medieval life, how difficult do you think it would be to recreate that with modern learning for children to experience?
With virtual and augmented reality, the possibilities are tremendous. One of my lockdown projects with a friendly teenager was to reconstruct Merton Priory in Minecraft. And this is absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's quite blocky. It's like virtual Lego, if you don't know it. But it really gives you a sense of exploring a monastery of that time. And I think augmented reality will be a game changer because we'll be able to have these images on our phones or our tablets and stand. So imagine you could go out to Barnwell Priory and you could be looking at Barnwell Priory as it was in, I don't know, 1236, as you're looking at the remains and actually walk around the site. Yeah. I think it'd be tremendous. Schools round here always go to Kentwell for a bit of Tudor reenactment, and I think that's really lovely. And I think also it's helpful to, you know, if you want to know about medieval buildings, it's helpful actually to create your own, even modestly, you know, from making lime or whatever it might be. In France, they're actually building a castle. They've been building it for the last, what, 2 decades. It's called Guédenon, and it's amazing, amazing structure.
What's the point in studying medieval history? What do you get out of it?
A lot of enjoyment. As you say, with all the literature is tremendous fun, actually, and really interesting, and the art. But we haven't changed, and I think it's good to look at different periods, different cultures, to examine ourselves. And I think there's a lot that the medieval period can actually teach us.
Katie Hawkes, thank you very much indeed for talking to me on Cambridge 105. It's been most interesting.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Cambridge Arts Roundup. I hope you've enjoyed listening in on Cambridge 105. I'm Simon Burton, and I'll be back with more creative stories in the near future.